I've been microdosing spider content.
It's always spooky.
Ooh, really?
Yeah, in an effort to try to like get rid of my fear. And it's working. I'm starting to see spiders as cute now.
And like cool.
Yeah, they're fascinating. Especially like cellar spiders that are like the apex of a hunting spider, but they can't do anything to us. Not a damn thing.
I know, it's super cool. I don't know if you've been to Pets on Broadway before. Have you been there?
Yeah.
Their little invertebrate section is super, super chill. And they got these new terrariums recently, and they look like coffins.
Cute. Like this big. Oh.
And you can buy jumping spiders there.
Oh, what?
Like, yeah.
You can buy jumping spiders there?
Yeah. They're like $20 to $25, I think, but they're so cute.
Oh my God, I love jumping spiders.
I love jumping spiders.
I was never scared of those to begin with. Mm-hmm. Like, those have always been adorable.
Adorable. They can see colors. Like, they're so awesome.
Oh my gosh. The ones that I've been really fascinated with lately are jumping spiders and wolf spiders, just because wolf spiders' eyes form, like the way that their eyes are structured, are so cool with the two on top and then a row at the bottom that's very like,
Yeah, they're really crazy looking.
They have some gnarly looking legs though.
Wolf spiders.
Yeah.
But anyways, I was trying to think of a good segue for our
that worked
episode today. I was going to come up with like a semi truck on an old country road joke and then ending up in a pet cemetery. And then I was like, I'll just fucking skip over that.
Yeah, we'll just glide right in.
Right over that.
Yeah.
So forgive me today, but I was telling Clark this before we started recording that I ordered new notebooks because for the first time in my life, I finished a notebook from page to page, and I didn't have anything to write today's notes on. And my notebooks arrived an hour before, like 2 hours from, like around 4 o'clock today. So,
yeah,
fuck me. I'm like shooting off by the cuff today.
That's all right. My notes definitely aren't as detailed as they have been.
That's all right. We don't have to be perfect.
But, so I read the book.
Yeah, and I watched the movie a couple of times. So, like, I've got a pretty good piece of it. This is a movie I had not seen before.
What?
Yeah, I had not seen it. It's one of those, like, Halloween and Misery where I was like, I knew the bits of it. And I was surprised at myself last night when I was watching it again. When I was like, most of the scenes that I remember from the movie happened in, like, the last 12 minutes.
Yeah.
And I remember looking at the time and I was like, holy shit, there's only 12 minutes left of this movie.
I'm excited to see how you feel about this movie because I fucking love this movie. And like, sure, the acting's not great.
It's awful.
It's like, it's a late 80s movie.
Yeah. Like, I was trying to give it that, that credit.
Yeah. It's not great, but it's a classic.
It is. It's a classic. That's literally what I kept trying to tell myself when I was not finding things scary and I was finding things really comical. Is I was like, I'm trying to imagine 1989, I've never seen anything like this before, and I'm going to the movie theater, and like I'm seeing this for literally the first time. No, nothing in cinema has ever been this crazy before. But
one of the things that I'm really appreciative of when Nick and I watch the movies together is Nick kind of has that perspective of somebody who is like the target audience for horror movies because he's not a fan of gory things. He doesn't watch a lot of horror. And so they do hit him hard.
Yeah.
And so we were watching this and especially like the scenes with Pascal and like that sort of stuff. He's like, that's gross.
I agree with you because it was making me think of watching Host with Becky and Owen.
Yeah.
Where I was like, oh my gosh, I put this movie on thinking we were all going to laugh our butts off watching this movie. And then it quickly became obvious to me that like they were genuinely terrified at several points. Right. And it just, I don't know, it kind of reignited something in me. Just like, okay, this is more entertaining. It's more entertaining because you're so scared of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So this movie for me, it's not scary. Pet Sematary is not scary.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was the intention. Like, I don't know if it was supposed to be more shock factor and less scary or something like that.
Yeah.
But the book was really fucking good
and really scary.
It's hard for
dramatic.
I'm dead inside.
I got you.
Yeah.
I'll tell you before we get into our metadata, the concept of this movie is super scary.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And even some of the events that unfold in it are super terrifying, and we'll get into them as we're talking about it. But I think what really pulled it out for me was a lot of those kind of like pitfalls of like, how could you be that complacent of not watching your child to where they die, right? Because it happens multiple times where they're not watching him and he almost gets crammed by a truck.
Yeah.
And then even further with the whole pet cemetery thing, like that other dude knew that it was bad and was cursed. So all of those events that happened in the movie didn't really seem like they needed to happen. Yeah. It was a very specific set of circumstances, but the events that unfolded, some of them are truly terrifying. It's just the acting was terrible. And yeah. just that idea of like, is this really realistic? Is this really what people would do in this scenario? Maybe it is. Anyways.
And you get it lot more in the book. Okay. Of course, there's always more to it in the book.
Yeah.
I'm excited to be able to lend some of that as we go through this, because there is so much more behind why things play out the way that they do.
Okay.
And
okay.
The movie just doesn't do a good job of executing it. But also, they were working with, you know, an hour and a half ish, like that sort of thing. So
right. And I don't know if you know off the top of your head how many pages the book is.
It's like 300 something.
Okay. So that's
somewhere around there.
It's pretty average book size. But still, like, it's hard to condense all of that material into a 90-minute movie.
But they did get Herman Munster, who truly, Fred Gwynn, is the good actor in this movie.
He made a lot out of that character. I don't know what the character was like in the book, but he made a lot out of that character.
He nailed Judd.
Nice.
Like,
nice.
He is perfect. Well, let's get into
it. I know, we need to get into it. So we are doing the 1989 Pet Cemetery. I'm looking up everything because literally I don't have anything written down. So we are literally at the mercy of my slow ass phone. But luckily you have editing at your fingertips.
We have the power of post-production on our side.
So directed by Mary Lambert, writer is Stephen King. The tagline for this movie, I had to look up a separate one because it was just like the number one, you know, best-selling iconic terror from the number one best-selling novel.
I know what I would give it of a tagline.
Ooh, what would you give it?
Sometimes dead is better.
Yeah, of course. Here's a couple of other ones. Don't forget to put the cat out before the cat puts you out.
Oh!
A magical place where a child's best friend can come back and live forever as an adult's worst nightmare. And if it works for animals... home is where the horror is, and then sometimes dead is better.
Yeah. That is one of the like quotes that on the Stephen King subreddit is the most popular.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's the tagline for the book and the movie, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And it's a quote from the movie, at least, that's spoken several times. Judd says that line like at least a half a dozen times.
The two like quotes that are pulled from that movie the most, one of them is sometimes dead is better. Mm-hmm. The second one is just
yep. The title card for this movie, very simple, black background, white font, but what I like about it is cemetery is obviously spelled incorrectly. It's with an S instead of a C, which I think is to lead into the fact that like children made it and they didn't know how to spell cemetery, so it was like their closest bet. But I did like that the T in cemetery is a head marker, like a gravestone. I appreciated that.
That was a well-done font that they made.
Yeah, it was a nice detail, even though it was a simple title card.
Yeah.
Finally, I'm going to do budget. So budget was $11.5 million estimated. Opening, wow. I know, $11.5 million in 1989.
Damn.
Yeah. Okay, opening weekend in U.S. and Canada was April 21st, 1989, where it made just over $12 million.
Sick.
So it made its budget in the first weekend, which is nice. And then U.S. gross in Canada was about $57.5 million.
Damn.
So it definitely...
They did well.
Oh, it did really fucking well. Let's go ahead and we'll do our quick little recap first.
Oh, yeah.
And then we'll do themes. And.
Oh, wait. We got to do cast.
Oh, shit. Here, I got it. I got you.
Okay, sick. I was going to say, I have it in a chart, too.
In a chart?
Yeah.
Oh, fuck yeah. Oh, is that from, like, IMDb?
No, I format it this way because I'm annoying.
Oh my God. Okay. So the cast for this, Dale Midkiff plays Lewis Creed, the dad. Denise Crosby plays Rachel Creed. Fred Gwynne plays Judd Crandall. Brad Greenquist plays Victor
Pascal.
That's what it is. It didn't show his entire name. It has Michael Lombard, who plays Irwin. And then Miko Hughes plays Cage. And then Blaise Birdall is Ellie. Oh, and I guess I should put Susan Blomart played Missy.
Rip.
Yeah, right. Zelda was played by Andrew Hubacek.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to give a little bit of extra information about Fred Gwynne.
Okay.
Because I love him. I am obsessed with him. I was raised watching the Munsters. Mm-hmm. Like, he is an icon.
I also know him from My Cousin Vinny.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So he was a legend. Like, he very, very well known, very famous actor. Mm-hmm. And he had one of my favorite mindsets around being an actor and being famous.
Right.
He is very well known for having a harsh separation between work and home. Mm-hmm. And he would refuse to do interviews. He refused to do like extra stuff. He would go there for his assigned acting roles. And then he would go home on a farm in like rural New England. Mm-hmm. And not talk to a soul.
Wow.
Like, he just had his family out there, didn't do paparazzi, didn't do interviews, and was just like, that's just my work. This is my home. And I keep those very distant.
Aww.
And I love that.
Yeah, that's so important too.
Yeah.
For an actor.
Yeah. And I guess like he was very well known for being like a very warm, very affectionate person. Ugh. But he was very to himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, but he also really liked his private time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he also was like fucking ridiculously tall, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, like he's
standing
he's
in his
big guy.
Presence, you're just like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Please don't crush me.
Such an excellent person, though.
Like, yeah.
And he didn't live very long, sadly, but, you know.
The good die young.
They do. Yeah. And then the evil... They
stay alive.
Stay around forever and run the country.
I mean, and you know what's really cute is Judd actually says that. I think after Missy dies.
Yeah.
He says, man, that really blows that, you know, she passed away when she had so much extra life to live. And I'm just sitting around doing nothing. Like just aging and, you know, saving babies from getting creamed by trucks.
Yeah, just drinking beer and smoking cigarettes on my porch all night.
And hanging out with my neighbors. Because that's literally the only civilization for miles.
Yeah.
I was kind of curious about the situation. Like, it seemed like maybe they lived just outside of town and like they had moved there so that Lewis could be the new small town doctor.
Yes. Yeah. So
I did get it.
So Lewis gets a job at the college. And so he's going to be like the new doctor. He was a surgeon, but he's moving into just being like a campus doctor, essentially.
Right.
And they live just outside the town of Ludlow, Maine.
Okay.
And
okay.
In the book, they build a lot more around like where this is situated in reference to like Bangor. And it's also referenced in its proximity to Derry.
Nice.
And like that sort of thing. So it's definitely in the universe in like a really full way.
That's super cool. I fucking love that.
Right? But yeah, they're just there initially because they were living in Chicago, and then Lewis wanted to accept a little bit less stress of a position and just go work at the college where they assumed nothing big would ever happen.
Right, where the worst of his day would be like a sprain here and there, not somebody getting hit by buses.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, do you want to do our recap?
Yeah. I had a really hard time writing like
a
spoiler-free synopsis for this one, but I got one.
I feel like, I'm sorry, even with the newer movie that's come out, like I think the newer movie's been out for at least a decade at this point. And everybody knows Pet Sematary for that scene.
Yeah.
So I just don't even feel bad.
I just tried to make it super vague.
Yeah.
And so I wrote, Ludlow, Maine has its share of secrets. When tragedy befalls the Creed family, they learn of one high up in the hills behind their home.
See, I like that. That's super ambiguous.
Yeah, because like anything else you say about it is going to give it away.
Yep. All right. So for themes.
Mm-hmm. I gotcha.
All right.
Yeah. I knew
you were coming.
I got it. grief.
Grief.
Yes.
Yeah, of course.
Grief. Ethics/morality. And defying nature.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yep. That's what happens when you play God.
Yeah. Yeah. when you just like don't learn from your first mistake or your second mistake.
Yeah. Also, speaking of playing God, it's kind of perfect timing that this is coming out when they've decided to pull the dire wolf out of extinction.
Yeah, I haven't seen too much about this.
Yeah.
They just probably synthesized DNA and...
Yeah.
Interesting.
I don't feel good about that.
Whatever. I'm just like, I don't feel good about a lot of things at this point. I have literally no control over them.
Nothing
so.
Makes me feel good anymore.
some things do, just not a lot.
Yeah. Just...
it's just few and far between, that's all.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have any other themes to add in there?
I'm trying to think of some right now. Just it could also be like the loss of innocence too, because the whole point of the pet cemetery is that Judd was saying that like children have to learn about death sometime, mm-hmm. right? And a lot of times that's how children learn about death is through the death of like one of their pets, because just pets just don't live that long.
Yeah.
Especially depending on the pet, like if it's a hamster or a goldfish, right? Or they learn about death by like older family members passing away or through other accidents and things like that.
Yeah.
So I could also see like loss of innocence also being a theme.
Absolutely. Yeah.
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 But other than that, I can't really think of any others.
No. And I think the book probably explores things a little bit deeper, you know?
Than the movie does.
Yeah. Which tends to be the case frequently with King movies.
Right.
Like, the books are always better.
Right.
Yeah.
I believe it. Shall we get into our favorites and scariest?
Or actually, I'll go into a little bit of lore first.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I am so down.
So I want to start off with saying like the lore section, if it's a movie that's based on a book, I'm also going to kind of tie in like lore and then
book.
Ways that the novel is like playing into the movie, that sort of thing. With this
sure.
one. The movie is actually hella close
to the book. Nice.
Like, there's definitely backstory that would have cleared up a lot of things that the movie leaves fairly ambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
Like Nick was pointing out that he didn't really understand why Zelda was brought into things at the end and why it was that Judd even like took him to the pet cemetery in the first place and like that sort of stuff.
Yes. I also have questions about the dead guy.
Oh, Pascal?
Pascal, yes.
Yeah.
I understood why he showed up for Lewis, but I didn't understand why he showed up for his wife.
Yeah.
What was his wife's name?
Rachel.
Rachel.
Yeah. So I might be misremembering, but I don't think he shows up for Rachel.
You're right. I don't think he does.
Book.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I'm thinking back on it now, and I think he shows up to Lewis for the nightmare and he takes him outside, right? But then the rest of the times that he shows up, I don't think that the other people in the room see him besides Lewis, but he somehow influences other people.
Yes.
Like he gets them to say things or to do certain things. So he's like a third party.
Yeah.
In all of the situations. And that was a question I had. I was like, wait a second. Did this happen in the books? Like, this is kind of strange.
And he does show up for Ellie, both in the movie and in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And he shows up for Lewis. But yeah, in other ways, he just is kind of, I think, supposed to be the barrier that's trying to keep them from going further and further into this hole that they're digging themselves in.
Sure.
But that was a little bit of something that I feel like I would have to go back and reread a good chunk of the book to figure out, like, was he in everybody else's business as he was
in the movie?
Because that did seem a little odd to me. But to kind of clear up a little bit about like Judd's motive for bringing Lewis to the Mi'kmaq burial grounds to begin with,
mm-hmm.
in the book, they go a lot more in depth with like, he doesn't necessarily believe that he made the decision to bring him there. It's that the burial grounds essentially made the decision for him to bring him there.
Okay, I can appreciate that.
Yeah.
I can appreciate that because I thought where you were going with that was that Judd was like, well, I don't really think that it was burying Spot in the burial ground is the reason why he came back rabid, right?
Yeah.
Because I just thought to myself, I was like, you fucking knew what was going to happen, bro. Why would you encourage him to go bury his goddamn cat out there?
So the other thing, too, in the book, not everything comes back mean. Like, they come back different.
Yeah.
But they don't necessarily come back hostile.
Hostile and hostile. Oh, got it.
One specific animal that they talk about in the book that comes back hostile, and it's this guy's bull that he buried up there.
Jesus.
Yeah, and it came back angry.
Raging.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
Came back Red Bull. And
Red Bull. Well, and I also thought to myself, too, there's two sections to the pet cemetery, too, yeah. Right? There's the pet cemetery, and there's the Micmac burial grounds, mm-hmm. which is like in a different section of the cemetery area. Sorry.
It's very far from it, too.
Okay. So that could also be part of it, too.
Yeah, that's part of it, because he introduces them to the pet cemetery because that's kind of supposed to be that, like, this is where the dead speak. This is where the kids learn about it and, like, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because the road uses a lot of animals.
Yep.
And then past the blowdown, which you truly shouldn't be able to walk over, that's where you get, it's like a miles long trail that it's supposed to be that takes you up to the Micmac burial grounds where the dead walk.
Right.
Yeah.
Got it.
So I think the intention was showing the pet cemetery because Ellie was curious about where the path led.
And, yeah, of course.
And also in the book, the kids from the town take care of the pet cemetery.
Yeah,
and
of course.
So like they take care of the path. They talk about how like well manicured the path is, how well manicured the pet cemetery itself is, because right, all the kids go there.
And it's not overgrown.
No, right. It's not overgrown. It's very well manicured.
Yeah, it's just well taken care of.
Yeah, but I don't think he ever intended on showing Lewis the Micmac burial ground. I think the Micmac burial ground decided that for him.
I can appreciate that. I can appreciate it. I wish they could have done anything in the movie to...
Agreed.
To bring that up. Even if it would have been like Judd waking up in the middle of the night and just like, I don't know, getting up and going to Lewis's house and waking him up, or even just having like, I don't know how I would do it. I'm trying to think of how I would do it practically in a movie. I might have like Judd having a nightmare and him waking up kind of the same way that Lewis did.
Yeah.
Where he had already committed the act, right?
Yeah. It didn't land as well, because there is a section later on in the movie where Judd and Lewis are having a talk at the kitchen table, and he kind of talks about how like, I think I may have inadvertently killed your son.
Okay.
Like that sort of
thing. I do remember that line. Yeah. Right. And
I think their mindset there was trying to say that like, it was trying to say that like, I didn't necessarily want to introduce you to this place, but I did introduce you to this place. And because of that, these things happened, because the burial ground has a pull on everything now. And they just didn't word it well enough for that to come across.
Yeah.
But yeah, if they would have just done it the way that it was written in the book, it actually would have been better. Which is strange that Stephen King wrote the screenplay to and didn't write
and
that
couldn't
part
figure
very
that
well.
Out. Yeah, because I would have even accepted if Judd would have just heard like a whispering voice being like, take him to the burial ground.
Literally anything.
And literally anything.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Then the other thing was Zelda being involved in as much of it as Zelda was.
Right.
So in the book, very early on, you learn that Rachel is like vehemently afraid of death.
Okay.
Because of the things that happened with her sister, she doesn't talk about it. She doesn't go to funerals.
Right.
She is completely separated herself from any sort, like from the subject.
Absolutely.
Altogether.
Yep.
And so I think the way that they were using Zelda was to be a representation of death and like that fear.
Yeah.
And they did a fairly decent job with showing what happened with Zelda and also making Zelda a very frightening character.
Right.
But the way that they had Zelda brought back in later when Rachel goes into Judd's house and like all that kind of stuff.
Right.
That just didn't make a ton of sense. I think it was supposed to be that she's supposed to represent like, oh, death is here. Mm-hmm. Like that sort of thing.
Right.
But they didn't equate the fear well enough. I don't think they did well enough at making Zelda be the symbol of how much Rachel has separated herself from that subject.
Absolutely.
Because I don't feel like they ever really talk about her being afraid of death or being like,
yeah.
Yeah.
They just talk about the only times that you really see it is when like after Missy dies and Ellen is asking Lewis about like, do you think Missy went to heaven?
Yeah.
And after that conversation that Lewis has, Rachel pulls Lewis aside and is like, I don't know if I feel comfortable with us talking to Ellen about death. And I don't remember what Lewis says. It's probably something like she has to learn about it sometime. Like we're not going to be able to insulate her from it for forever.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. I feel like that first time that Zelda came in, it was really just to set that precedent of like Rachel experienced this traumatic event. And I can see how that would make her afraid of death. And then that subsequent of like, I don't really want you talking to our daughter about death. And I'm constantly worried about like our son dying and like us not watching him. But when Zelda comes back later on, it just it doesn't make a lot of sense because why would she be there in the first place? Like the only terrorizing thing would have been Gage, who came back to life as like a zombie. So Zelda being there like as just an apparition, like their house was haunted. Was it just a manifestation that like the burial grounds had created just to instill more terror in Rachel? So it just kind of seemed like a curveball.
Yeah.
To throw like three quarters of the way through the movie that just kind of pulled you out of it and didn't serve the plot line either. Agreed. Other than to just be something else scary and shocking to show on screen.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. If they would have leaned a little more into the Zelda narrative of the book, it would have been far more effective.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Like having her there at the end, I feel like the symbolism of it would have made sense. Mm-hmm. But they didn't. So she's just like, why is she there?
What? Yeah. And yeah, even if they would, now that you're talking about it and you're saying that like Rachel had this big fear of death, I can kind of see it, right? But it just would have been nice, even though I don't really like exposition that much, just for us to even hear her utter the words of yeah. like, I'm afraid of death. I don't like talking about it. I don't like thinking about it.
Every time I think about it, I think about my sister dying in front of me. Yeah. Like, yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And she could have even started with those three sentences before telling Lewis about Zelda's death.
Yeah.
Right? The like, this is why I don't like talking about it, is this incident. You wouldn't have to bring it up again after that point.
Instead of just the breakdown of like...
Yeah, instead of her just like giving you the memory and then that three quarters of the way through just having Zelda come back just for this last fright.
Yeah.
Just this last, like, I'm finally here for you, Rachel. I'm going to come kill you.
Yeah. And when they remade it, they didn't do it any better. So
I think I saw part of the remake. I feel like it was like American Psycho where like I started it and then shut it off. You know, I was just like, this is so not good.
Yeah.
But
the last little bit about lore that I have is I just wanted to touch a little bit on what soured the burial grounds. Mm-hmm. So in the book, the lore behind the Micmac burial grounds is tied to the Wendigo.
Yeah.
And so essentially what they say is that like the Micmac tribe used to use those burial grounds, but then at some point the Wendigo took hold, soured the grounds, and now anything that comes from it is not necessarily evil, but it's just corrupt.
It's different. Okay.
And so there are a lot of different variations of how Wendigo come to be and how they appear.
Mm-hmm.
But specifically in Pet Sematary, the Wendigo is described as a giant hairy beast that is momentarily seen in the latter half of the book.
Yeah.
Like you don't see it at all. I don't feel like I remember seeing it in the movie.
No.
But
I don't even think you hear the word Wendigo in the movie.
Yeah. But you do see it in the book. And the journey of them walking down the path mm-hmm. every time is terrifying. Like there's like disembodied voices and like children laughing Ooh. In like this dense fog and that Ooh. Sort of stuff. He gets chased by the Wendigo at one point.
Okay. Lewis does?
Yeah.
Got it.
But in the folklore, the Wendigo is a dangerous, cannibalistic creature that's created by the corruption of a human soul, mm-hmm. typically because of greed, mm-hmm. but can also be due to like severe weaknesses like starvation, when somebody's like severely isolated, when they're cold, or even when they're going through intense grief, which I think is yep. how they're tying it into this.
Yep.
But they don't talk about the lore at all in the yeah. movie.
And yeah, they don't talk about why the ground's sour or what that means, right?
Yeah, and so I thought it was important to touch on that because that is actual, like, real lore for the tribes in that area.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Okay. That's super cool. I was curious. I'm excited that you brought that up because I was wondering why they considered the ground sour, and I wanted to look up the definition of an Indian burial ground, right? Because when I think of an Indian burial ground, I think of a place that used to be sacred, but then colonizers came in, kicked them out, and then like bastardized it somehow.
Yeah.
Paved over it and put a building on top of it or desecrated it in some way. And so then after that point, it became haunted.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that is kind of how it is used nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, for that specific use case, it's very much so just like, that was just a place that they used to bury things. And then one day the Wendigo was like,
So it's kind of similar, right? Instead of colonizers coming in and bastardizing it or demolishing it and desecrating it in some way, it was a creature. And so I think it's interesting. I don't know that it's interesting, but I know a little bit about Wendigos, but mostly from urban legends and like from video games and things like that. And so it's interesting that it's like some kind of cryptid that came in and took over this area and then somehow also desecrated it and cursed it.
Yeah.
Right? Which kind of makes sense. I think Wendigos are created out of those circumstances that you were talking about, and then also cannibalism. When they resort to cannibalism, they turn into a Wendigo, which is a kind of like half beast, half man creature that then just wants to like, is not really a zombie, but is kind of just like a monster, just wants to kill people, eat things. And then typically wherever it is created is just cursed.
And thank you for bringing that up, because there is a small bit of narrative in the book where they talk about the Wendigo being created out of that need to be cannibalistic.
Yeah.
And it is because of a colonizer situation where it's like they're starting to take over Mi'kmaq lands.
Oh, gotcha. And, right.
And it's
and cannibalizing
like,
it. Right.
Yeah. And then the Mi'kmaq themselves end up having to resort to cannibalism because of a lack of resources.
Right.
And they kind of lightly touch on that potentially being where the Wendigo came from.
Hmm.
But they give a couple different things that it could.
That's kind of cool. And I like that it is an active, like tangible creature in the books.
Yeah.
Where they don't even bring it up in the movie.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
It is.
Maybe they just for the 1980s, they're just like, we can't come up with a monster that's going to be cool enough to actually put on screen.
Yeah.
So we'll just really lean into like the cat and the baby.
Yeah.
Which I'll be honest with you, like that baby was pretty creepy.
That baby.
He was fucking so cute though.
So cute.
So cute.
No fair.
Fair.
Should we get into our favorites?
Let's do it.
All right. You want to go first?
I mean, I could. I will tell you, I don't have anything written down, so I'm purely just like running my mouth right now. I think I want to say my favorite scene, if I just think about my favorite off the top of my brain, is probably one of the honorable mentions might be like when they go to the cemetery for the first time with Ellen. And the reason why I appreciate that scene is towards the end, Judd asks Ellen, like, do you know what cemeteries are for? And she says, well, no, I don't. And he says, they're not scary places. They're places where the dead speak. And she like gasps aloud. And he says, no, not literally. I just mean like they're headstones. Like their headstones are places where like you can come and learn who they are. It's like the cemetery is not a scary place. It's a place for rest. It's a place for tranquility. And it's a place for like coming and speaking to the dead.
Yeah.
And I liked that as like a way to educate young people into like, this isn't a scary place. This is a place where you come and you visit people, pay your respects. This is a place where like they have come at the end of their life to be at peace.
Yeah, there's a line in the movie. I wrote a quote down later, so we'll touch back to that.
Okay, okay. Yeah.
That is such a beautiful scene, though, because, like, Judd just kind of takes the reins with, like, oh, I'll teach her about it then.
Yeah, right? Right? Yeah, and I like how innocent, you know, little Ellen is, too, where she's like, Dad, look, it's a goldfish. You know, they're just looking at all these different things. Like, it's not just the road that's taken all of these different creatures. Like, sometimes kids will just come just to bury their animals because they've died of old age or of other circumstances. Like in Judd's case, because his dog like had an infection and died, right? Like from a cut that he had received.
Yeah, the way that Judd, both in the book and the movie, says the road uses a lot of animals.
Mm-hmm. It's a mean road.
Almost kind of turns it into like a creature itself.
It uses a lot of animals. Yeah, yeah. I kind of liked it. I was kind of wondering what the inanimate big bad was of this movie, right? Like Christine, it's a car, and like Misery, it's, well, not Misery, The Shining, it's the hotel, and like,
yeah.
And for this one, I was like, is it the burial ground? Is it the road? Is it, you know,
is it like greed
or like, what's the other sin that he's committing? Like just the, like, it's just like denial almost.
Yeah.
Just this like, no, it's probably greed.
Yeah. Something like that.
Or pride. Maybe it's pride. I don't know.
But yeah, I think it's the big bad is, I think it's supposed to be the burial ground, but the road is kind of tied. They're kind of one.
Yeah, absolutely. Or in the book, you know, the bad is like the Wendigo, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm trying to think if there's anything else that I want for favorite. Like, obviously there's a lot of really great scenes in this movie. I don't know why I'm not coming up with any of them now. Well, why don't you do some of your favorites? And then if I think of any other ones, I'll bring them up after.
Yeah. There are a couple that are just like a little general.
Right.
So I lumped them together in one statement. That's just any scene with Judd. I love Judd.
Oh, he's sure.
Like, he is one of my favorite characters of anything ever. Mm-hmm. Like, he is, and in the book, he's even more so, but he is just so wholesome and so, like, just old-time rural Maine.
Yes, he's a very, like, thick, kind of slow, almost molasses accent.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I like his character a lot. He's very sweet.
He is.
You can also tell that he's, like, very eager to like have people to hang out with.
Yeah.
And it seemed like it was a different time back then when like your neighbors would literally just come into your house. Like they didn't knock first. They literally just opened your door and just walked in.
Well, I don't feel like they did a very good job in the movie of showing this, but it's literally like the day that they move in, Judd goes and tells Lewis, like, I'll be on my porch drinking beer. Come over if you want. And
dude,
like
right?
From day one,
oh, yeah.
Like Lewis talks about how he sees a kinship in Judd that he hasn't really seen in anybody.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. They become best friends literally like the second they meet.
That's literally so cool.
Yeah. And it's such a cute relationship. And Judd's wife is actually a character in the book.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
He has a wife in the book.
He does.
Okay.
He does. And he's such a genuine, compassionate character.
Yeah.
And he's just Fred Gwynn did such a good job.
I'll give a quick shout out. This is a slight tangent, but I actually had a neighbor similar to Judd in Drain, because I remember when we first moved into our house in Drain, it was flooded by a teenager, so we had to live in a tent for the first couple of weeks in the summertime while we were waiting for the, like, you know, foundation to be redone. And one of the first nights that we were there, we were getting close to sundown. Our neighbors up the street from us, like literally the house above us, they came and they brought us food. They're like, hey, we know you guys just moved in. Like, we made you guys food. They made us spaghetti and garlic bread and like a salad and everything. And they had brought it down and it was just like an immediate like camaraderie. Like, I remember going over to their house constantly. I remember the neighbor like calling herself Mama Sherry. She had like a rule in her house. It was like, make yourself at home or get out. You know, like,
my other honorable mention. Well, there's two more. One of my other honorable mentions is not fair. That's not fair.
Yes.
It's like at the culmination of everything, all of the story tying together, and Lewis has just stuck Gage with a huge ass syringe of morphine to try to get him gone.
Oh yeah.
And he sticks him with it, and Gage starts to like stumble back a little bit, and he's like stumbling and falls against the wall, and he's just going, "That's not fair.
Yeah,
that's not, that's fair. Not fair." And then he just dies.
Yeah, I know, right? I did actually kind of like that, because if you think about it, at the end, like, he is still a 3-year-old, so like he'd be pretty easy to punt across the room or like hold down or whatever. And so I just kind of liked it. Like, I would have liked to see how he killed Rachel, because it was interesting how he killed Judd. It was a little cheesy at times, but like,
yeah,
it was still clever and whatever, right? Like, but I was thinking to myself when Lewis finally grabbed him and stuck him, I was like, thank you, because like it would literally be that easy. Yeah.
The way he just like yeets him down the stairs at one point too is so good.
I can't wait to get into the trivia to kind of figure out how they did that. Like when he was doing the not fair, when he goes and I hope to God that wasn't the actual baby, because the way he goes and he just like slams his head against the wall, yeah. I was just like, oh baby.
Oh, I have to say, because Nick knows how I feel about when movies don't have the balls to kill the kid.
Yeah.
And so as Gage is going up to the road and mm-hmm. there's the giant Orenco truck coming down, Nick starts cheering. He's like, yeah!
I remember just thinking to myself, like, how much those parents really just deserved it. Because I just, how could you not keep your fucking eyes? There was so much distance between where they were hanging out with that kite and where that baby got hit by that truck, right? And you're just like, what the fuck are you guys doing? And there was two of you. Like, you can't just all put it on Lewis. Like,
the book fucks with you at that moment, too.
Does it? Because,
so, a little bit of explanation as to, like, when that moment happens.
Yeah, we should just talk about it, because it's not the scariest scene for me.
No. Like, it's... When that moment happens, in the book, they talk about how, like, the driver ends up going into, like, a super deep depression, and he says something to the effect of, like, I don't know what came over me. I was driving, and all of a sudden, I just had this desire to just, like, put the pedal to the metal and just, like, go down this road. And I don't know if it was because I was getting close to home. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it was, but something just came over me and told me, like, floor it.
Yeah,
and
got it.
They're saying that, like, essentially the burial ground possessed him into
doing, or like
it.
Something in the road, right?
And Judd even says, like, and they kind of touch on it in the movie a little bit, but he's like, there's nothing you could have done. The road decided it wanted your kid.
Yeah.
Like that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And so the way that the scene plays out in the movie, it happens almost exactly the way that it does in the book.
Okay.
But he gets much closer. Like, I think he talks about his fingers grazing his clothes.
Right.
Almost
it was
has
just
him.
There.
And it was literally like one of those things where he was there and they literally turn around, look back, and he's at the road. Almost like he just gets there without anybody even having the
ability.
Like
somehow the road like sped Gage up, or even just like moved the ground underneath him, so he'd be right next
kinda,
to it.
Yeah.
Right. Like, or like the kite string, they just lifted him off the ground and just flew him over there.
Because also those are two separate scenes in the book. Mm-hmm. The kite scene happens before Gage dies, like separate days. Even.
Got it. Okay, I gotcha.
Where like, and it is, oh my God, the kite scene is written so beautifully. I was crying through that whole scene.
Aww.
It's just this gorgeous scene of this dad and son having this connection together. And like, he talks about how he like kisses him on the forehead, and he just like, he's exuding how much he loves this kid and everything.
Yeah.
And then it's literally like two pages later, kid's dead.
Yep.
And they don't talk about what happened initially. They just talk about how, who would have thought that the big bad was going to be a truck? And then the next page they're talking about his funeral and like how they're putting together all of the stuff for
his
memorial and like all that kind of stuff.
Oh man.
And they go through this whole spiel about how here's the funeral, here's this fight that breaks out between Lewis and Rachel's dad, and here's the burial, and here's what happened. They like slightly dig back into the truck scenario.
Got it.
And then they talk about how like maybe it was just a dream. He's like, what actually happened was I grabbed him and I pulled him back and everything was okay.
Right.
And then right after that, he's dead again. And so they fuck with you in this book. Like, King's like, beautiful scene, dead kid. Just kidding, he's not dead. No, really, he's actually dead.
No, he's actually dead. It's interesting. Like, I wonder, is it supposed to be told from Lewis's perspective?
A lot of
right? So, because like, you can kind of imagine, like, his brain fracturing and, like, you know, dissociating. Because I will tell you, as just, like, a... Now that we're talking about it, like, I did like when he gets hit by the truck and he fucking gets hit by that truck.
He gets
and
hit.
After that point, they do this cool thing where you see Lewis's reaction. He shouts no. And then they do like these side by side kind of like flashes. And then they show like a picture of like Gage on his birthday or like picture of them at the beach or like the picture of them on his the first day he was born. Right. And it just kind of like this contrast of like, this child is now gone.
Yeah.
He was here 1 second and he is gone the next. And then to further that point, the audacity of that fucking grandpa. Like, when somebody at one point says, Lewis, it's your child's funeral. Get control of yourself. And I literally said it. I was like, are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah.
Get him under control. How fucking dare he?
Rachel's dad is a fucking prick through the whole book.
Well, like, he's fucking pricked throughout most of the movie, too.
Yeah. He, fuck that guy.
Yeah.
Fuck that guy heavy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, uh-uh.
Mm-mm.
Nope, 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 nope.
Nope, 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 nope.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. There's, I know I say this all the time. You got to read the book. Because, like.
I will.
Please do. Because the way that they talk about, like, how at one point Lewis's memory flashes and he sees Gage's cap that he was wearing, but it's full of blood because it was keeping his head together. Like that sort of thing. They talk about how like the truck hit him and just like carried him for like quite a while. And he is a wreck in the book. Like, I think he has like an arm that's hanging on barely.
Yeah. I was kind of curious when they, you know, they had like the closed casket funeral and everything. And like, but when the casket gets knocked down and you just see the little baby hand, like I thought to myself, I was like, I'm kind of actually curious what that fucking baby would look like after you, like, because if we're being honest, like, have you ever seen videos of like animals that get hit by trains?
Oh yes.
Right. And they don't look anything like they did beforehand, because like we're all just fucking meat bags, right? Yeah. So I thought to myself, I was like, I don't know if that baby would look like that.
No,
I feel like you probably have a funeral where it's just like a bunch of pieces in a box. Yeah.
No, I existed on the internet before content moderation, and I saw way too much shit.
Way too much shit.
Yeah,
I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, man, I would just cremate it. But maybe if you're just really religious, you're like, nah, just collect as many pieses as possible.
We'll just try to Mr.
Potato. Are they allowed into heaven if you don't have all the pieces? God, I'm such a fucking awful person.
You weren't the one that was sitting in front of the TV cheering for the truck.
Nick.
And then my favorite scene.
Okay.
Is after Judd initially introduces Lewis to the Micmac grounds, not just the pet cemetery, but the Micmac grounds. They're sitting at a table having a couple beers, and Lewis asks Judd if they've ever buried a person in the Micmac grounds. And Judd just like reacts really quickly and like knocks beer bottles over. And he's like, Christ on his throne. No, never. Who would do that?
Who would do that?
Yeah, he says like, no, and who would? And just like his reaction was gold.
It was so good in the movie. Just like, holy, why would you even suggest that? Jesus Christ.
Just like knock everything over. Christ on his throne. Yeah, that was my favorite
scene. That was pretty fucking good.
What do you have for scariest? I was able to come up with one collection of honorable mentions and one kind of scary. It's not scary movie. Or not a scary movie.
I'm trying to like imagine going to theater, never seen anything like it before. Judd's death, I can see how that could be kind of scary. So I'll give that kind of like an honorable mention of just like him thinking he hears Gage like around his house, right? And so he's looking for him. But you see that like shot of just his ankles with those slippies on. And I'm just like, and you know, Gage has that like giant scalpel and you're just like, ooh. It's but, tendon cutting time.
And like you had said, though, because Nick saw that and was like, no, 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 and like looked away for a second. If I had never seen someone's Achilles get cut until that point.
That was some, it was a practical effect for sure. And yeah. And it was pretty gnarly. He only got the one cut too. But then like when his mouth got cut, like that to me was just funny. Because I was like, how could you die from that? And then the little baby bite mark, like,
yeah,
was also something. I will also give kind of some props too for like kind of creepiest scene to, when Lewis gets a phone call from Gage.
Oh my God.
He's like, Daddy, I want you to come play with me. Like, I played with Judd and I played with Mommy and I want to play with you now.
Oh, yes, Daddy. Will you come over and play with me?
And the reason why I really like that is because when he finally goes over, he finds Judd's body. That's super terrifying. And then he goes upstairs and he's like looking for Gage, or he's like having this confrontation with Gage, and you just see Rachel's feet swinging in the background. And I just kind of really liked that. And they don't ever really address it. They don't really show her at all in that kind of scene. It's very apparent that she's dead that whole time, right? Until the end when he's carrying her body, right?
Yeah.
So I can really, really appreciate that. And then again, like, I don't really see this as a scary scene, but it's still something that I will bring up, is just the very, very end. I kind of like his full psyche break where he's carrying Rachel's body to the burial grounds. And I want to say it's Pascal that's telling him, like, don't do it. No, wait, you can't do that. And he's like, no. Trust me. I have the formula down. Last time I waited too long. With Gage, I waited too long. She's fresh. She just died. So like, I can do it now.
Yeah.
And I can appreciate that, even if I didn't find it scary.
And I feel like with the book, the ending is slightly more ambiguous. Like, you still get that moment, but you don't get after that moment where they're like in the kitchen and that whole thing.
Oh, with
Rachel and
okay,
Rachel and, coming back and all that. Yeah. So you see him take her up, but then, or you see him walking with her, mm-hmm. but then shortly after, he's sitting in the kitchen and the clock hits midnight and she walks in.
Oh,
and
I guess
then
I
she has like the oozing out of her eye.
You're right. Like, no, you're right. I guess for some reason, like, I kind of blocked that out. Like, I kind of had thought that like the movie had ended with him just taking her to the cemetery, but you're right. I forgot about that kind of like
it's gross
post scene. Yeah.
That was a gross scene.
Yeah.
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 But yeah, I don't remember the book going to that point. I feel like it stopped before that.
Okay.
And left it a little more ambiguous. But yeah, there are a lot of scenes where it didn't have like the scare factor of some of the other scenes, but it left just enough to the imagination that it's like, yeah, that's creepy.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh,
Rachel swinging there like that.
Oh, that's fucking good. And also like, I don't know. I don't remember when Children of the Corn came out, but this is a great example of just like killer children.
Yeah.
Because that is scary. That is scary. Yeah. When like the assailant is not just a loved one, but like a child.
Yeah.
You know, like a child that like typically you would want to protect with your life. Right. And now they're running at you with a maniacal smile and a scalpel, like, you know.
Yeah.
So I can appreciate that, too.
No fair.
God, that baby was so cute. Like, he was so cute.
So for my honorable mentions
for scariest.
Scariest scene, it's mm-hmm. another collection. All of the Zelda scenes are just unsettling.
Like, yeah.
What they wanted to do, Nick told me about this actually, because he was Googling some things while we were watching it.
Got it.
They chose a man to play Zelda.
Right.
Because they wanted them, like with the makeup and everything, they just wanted them to look more frightening than they were able to make a woman look.
Absolutely.
At that point.
It was like Insidious.
It kind of like Insidious.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Where they were just like from afar would look disproportionate.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It would give more of a creep factor for whatever reason. Right.
Yeah. And it made sense because like the cakey amount of makeup that they had on him to make him look like that was unsettling.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
So like all the Zelda scenes, especially with like the super pronounced spine and all that, like they were just, they made Zelda look sickly enough that it had the right effect.
Oh, absolutely.
And then for me, the scariest scene was actually way in the beginning. When Pascal dies and then comes back, like with Lewis in the room.
Right.
To me, that was jarring.
Absolutely.
Like, Yeah.
Oh, and if you would have,
Yeah. Oh,
if you would have seen that in the theaters too, that would have been very like jump scare.
Yeah. Because also like the gore was pretty well done with Pascal, especially for this time frame. But the way that he just like comes back and he's like, the soil of a man's heart is stonier and Lewis. Knows Lewis's name and everything. In the book, I got like the heebie-jeebies from that. It was it was very well done.
I like when he, I can appreciate how Pascal's character kept coming back. Like I found it very interesting the way that like he came to Lewis in his dream. And at first Lewis is like, I just want to wake up. Just leave me alone. It's not my fault you died. I tried to help you. Like you were dead by the time you came to me anyways. Right. But then he convinces Lewis, like, you need to come with me. I need to come warn you about this burial ground and how you need to make sure that you're not crossing it. No matter what anyone tells you, like the ground is sour here. Don't come here. And then I like further that he keeps showing up in all of these different instances and other characters can't perceive him, but he's still somehow driving the narrative.
Yeah.
He's like pulling different threads or being like, you need to think about this or you need to go do that. And I found that to be a very interesting plot device.
Yeah. Or even like getting into Ellie's dreams. And like,
communicating with her.
Being like, your dad's going to do something bad.
Absolutely.
That sort of thing.
Right.
Tell me, like, in the beginning, Pascal is supposed to be a pretty scary character. Mm-hmm. Why is it all of a sudden he does a 180 and he's just, like, kind of serving?
He's super charming.
Like, he's super fun.
Yeah. I also found it interesting, like, Ellie's clairvoyance, too. Like, I don't know if that was just because she was a child. But the fact that like she kept having these dreams of like, oh, I had a dream that Church got hit by a car and you and Judd buried him at the pet cemetery. And I had a dream that mommy died, you know, like I had a dream here and there. Like I wonder where that came from too. Like if that had a deeper significance or if it was just a matter of like children are just more perceptive or.
I wonder if that's. I might have to look it up because I don't remember if they talk about it more in the book or I wonder if somehow that's going to tie into another thing in the Stephen King universe. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if Ellie appears again.
If that's like a shine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or like what it is. Because also, I guess in The Shining, they do talk about how like typically like kids and moms have a little bit more of it. And then it kind of dwindles as they get older, that sort of thing.
Right.
So I wonder if that's supposed to kind of lean into that a little bit.
Yeah, I wonder.
Maybe.
It's interesting.
They reference The Shining in the book. So.
Yeah.
Because there's a little section where it's Lewis's coworker says, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, right?
Oh, yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
I also thought I'd highlight this. This is probably pure coincidence, but that Lewis's character in Pet Sematary also has the nickname Doc several times. And every time I heard it, it made me think of The Shining.
Yeah.
I was wondering if that was also purposeful.
My goal in life is to infect everybody's brain with The Shining.
Like a little brain worm.
Yeah, like RFK Jr.'s brain worm.
So specific.
Yeah. I think I have a couple quotes, and then you want to do trivia?
Let's do it.
Okay. So, first quote. We already mentioned it. It's iconic. Sometimes dead is better.
Yes.
Second quote. Also iconic. Yep.
Yep.
All three of these quotes are by Judd. And then the third one, maybe she'll learn about what death really is, which is where the pain stops and the good memories begin. Not the end of life, but the end of pain.
Yeah.
Yeah. All philosophical in this page.
This is another one too. The soil of a man's heart is stonier, Lewis. A man grows what he can and he tends it. because what you buy is what you own, and what you own always comes home to you. Lewis, my father used to have a saying, Jed, God sees the truth, but waits. Oh, you already said this one, but has anyone ever buried a person up there? Christ on his throne, no. Whoever would.
Mom walked in when we were probably like two-thirds of the way through the movie. She was out last night, mm-hmm. and she came in and she heard Gage's laugh and was like, no.
Oh man, that is something I did want to bring up. Like every time I heard his laugh, I would do it. It was almost like a white chick's like, ah, ha, ha, ha. Like, yeah. Like it's just something in it. Like every time I heard it, it just made it get stuck in my head.
Mom hears Gage's voice and has a visceral reaction to it. Like you can tell, like she was at the right age when she watched this.
Right. That it fucking scarred her.
Yeah. Cause she would have been like in her early 20s. And yeah, just
yeah. I'm trying to imagine like going to see it for the first time. You'd never seen anything like it. It would have been pretty terrifying. Like yeah. The concept of coming home. I'm trying to remember what Lewis was doing the night before, and Judd and Rachel died. But when you come home and you realize that, like, you get this like creepy ass phone call from your dead son. Right. And then you go across the street and realize that he's murdered your wife and your best friend.
Yeah.
Right. Now you've got to fight him and kill him. Right. Like that all like on paper sounds super terrifying. It's just the way that the movie was shot just made it. And now like it just didn't age that well.
I do kind of want this is a reach. This is a really far reach. But I would like to see like a Flanagan Pet Cemetery. And see what he could do with it.
Yeah.
Because I feel like this has enough backstory that could make it so much more effective. And he is really good with adding in the right amount of background.
Oh, absolutely. For things. Oh, yeah. Yeah. If only. I'm sure he's so busy on other projects, though.
Right.
And Houston, are you ready to get into trivia?
Yeah.
All right. Let's do it. Stephen King once mentioned that the only novel he wrote that really scared him was Pet Sematary.
I could see it. Like when I had asked or when I was talking about Stephen King with Mayette, she was saying as a parent, Pet Sematary is the scariest one.
Yeah, absolutely. Not only from the idea of like losing your children in tragic accidents, but just also this idea of like if you had the opportunity to resurrect somebody. You knew for sure you could bring them back to life. They just maybe wouldn't be quite the same. Would you still take the risk? And I can understand that from a parent's perspective of like any the lengths that you would go to see your child again.
Yeah.
Even if it meant it wasn't your child. It was something else, but it was just close enough.
Yeah.
I can understand that. Bruce Campbell was the first choice for the role of Lewis Creed, who is the star in Evil Dead.
Oh, okay.
Kind of interesting. The role of Zelda, Rachel's terminally ill sister, was played by a man. Director Mary Lambert wanted Zelda in her scenes to frighten the audience, but did not believe that a 13-year-old girl was scary, so she cast Andrew Hubatzik in the role to make something be off about Zelda. All right. This is a spoiler warning. The story was inspired by actual events experienced by Stephen King that occurred while he was living in Orrington, Maine with his family. King recalled that while living there, his daughter's cat was killed on the highway. Much of Ellie Creed's emotional outburst was taken directly from King's own grief-stricken daughter. King also remembered that once, his youngest son had nearly run into the road while a truck was speeding down it, much like Gage does in the film. The character of Judge Crandall was based on the elderly neighbor that lived across the road from King. Also, there was an actual pet cemetery in the woods behind King's house, which became the basis for the one in the novel.
Hell yeah. That's, based on a true story.
That's dope as fuck.
Yeah.
That's super cool. Stephen King was present on location for most of the shooting of the film. The area it was shot in was only 20 minutes away from his home in Bangor, Maine. The house is in Hancock, Maine, about 45 minutes south of Bangor.
These houses are cool as fuck, too.
Yeah, yeah. I love the scenery in this movie. And I loved like the little pathway to the pet cemetery. Yeah. I really like the idea of it in the book of like it being this kind of sanctuary for children. to have something to tender to and to like have a place to lay their precious beloved animals to rest. I really like that.
Yeah.
The original screenplay featured the Wendigo, a Native American demon that was mentioned in the novel, but it was ultimately cut from the film. Its presence is implied only twice. First, in the scenes where Lewis is walking through the woods at night and hears something large knock down a tree. And second, when Judge first takes Lewis up to the Indian burial ground, there is some kind of loud crash deep in the forest, followed by a long, almost feminine howl. Judge says that it's only a loon.
Just a loon, that's all.
But it is clear that he does not entirely believe it himself.
He says in the book, when they very first walk down the path to go take church, he says, like, we're going to go over this. We're going to go over the blowdown. Don't look down. Walk right behind me. Just keep walking. Mm-hmm. Don't stop. That sort of thing. And then when they get over it and get to the foggy part, he's like, you're going to hear some noises. It's just loons. The sound of the loons just reverberates weirdly throughout the woods. Mm-hmm. Just keep going. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and I think that's cool, too, because I remember now when they are walking through and I think Lewis is just like, what is that? And Judd's like, oh, it's a loon. Like, I forgot that, like, that could have just been the Wendigo making sounds. When Victor Pascal is being carried into the clinic after being hit by a truck, a rabies poster with a picture of Cujo can be seen on the bulletin board by the stairs.
Yeah.
That's cool. I did not know that.
They make a reference to Cujo in the book too.
Oh.
They just talk about this family that gets killed by this rabid dog, but essentially. Oh, also, I forgot to mention it earlier, we get to see King in this one again.
I know.
Pastor King.
Pastor King. During the film, the character Judd, played by Fred Gwynn, mentions that he had a pet named Spot. Spot was also the name of the pet dragon on Gwynn's TV show The Munsters.
Yeah.
Director Mary Lambert said that Fred Gwynn was her first and only choice for the role of Judge Crandall.
Good.
When Church is killed for a second time at the climax, the needle is rigged to look as if it is sticking into him, but it is not. The cat was sedated by a veterinarian. A representative of American Humane was present, and the cat made a full recovery. Church. I hate that they had to fucking sedate him. That sucks, but
yeah,
at least he was being well cared for.
Sweet little Winston Churchill.
I know. I did, honestly, I do kind of like the name Church for a cat. Too. Like, it's just kind of fucking cool. Since cats are difficult to train, the film crew ended up using 9 cats, a jumper, a snarler, and a cuddler. No cats were harmed during filming. Other than the one that was sedated.
Yeah.
With the needle.
With the needle.
Assholes. I just like that, like, nobody was harmed in it. Just stuck somebody with a needle and drugged them up for a minute. It's fine.
If I had a nickel.
I know, right? The character of Missy is actually the blending of 2 characters into one. In the book, Missy does not commit suicide. The only characters that die prior to Gage's death are Pascal and Norma Crandall, Judd's wife.
Yep.
So does Judd's wife die the same way?
No. So Judd's wife is depicted as having, like, really bad arthritis, and she's in a lot of pain from it for a good majority of the time that she's present.
Right.
But then she ends up having a heart attack, I believe.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's a heart attack that takes her out. Because I think what happens is she has a heart attack, she ends up going to the hospital, and then I don't think she ends up coming home.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And then Judd gets really depressed, and that's another one of the reasons why I love his character so much, because you see, like, seeing such a sweet guy so sad is like,
and it would lead more into why he would probably lean on, like, Lewis and Rachel.
Yeah.
Like, in the movie, it translated just as well, just him being by himself and just kind of, like, being eager for community, being happy that there is somebody else that he can have community with. And it just, like, is fortuitous that, like, they get along, because, like, sometimes you don't get along with your neighbors. You don't get along well with them.
Yeah.
Every once in a while you do, though. Mary Lambert sees Victor Pascal as the good angel and Judd as the bad angel, she says, as the friendly old man is the one Lewis should be ignoring. His wardrobe, especially the large hooded jacket he's wearing when Church is found dead, is meant to suggest the darkness.
I feel like that worked.
That's pretty cool. I just find it cool that, like, she sees Victor Pascal as the good angel and Judd as the bad angel.
Yeah.
Because even if Judd is being corrupted by the road and the Wendigo and the burial ground, like, he is still, like, influencing Lewis in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
And then Victor is, like, the opposite side of the coin of, like, no, don't do it. Like, this is bad. This is sour. You shouldn't go here. Like, you're not supposed to be here.
Yeah. I like that, that each character is kind of, like, the opposite of the way that they're portrayed.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I just don't think it's meant to say that Judd is a bad person.
No.
Hmm. Cool. And I just like that, like, the director stated that.
Yeah.
That, like, that was their, that was her intention.
Well done.
Well done indeed. The storyline revolves on an omen, on the omen of being hit by the fast trucks on the road. Stephen King would himself suffer a similar accident in 1999 when he was struck by a minivan while walking on the shoulder of Route 5 in Lovell, Maine. The cat's glowing eyes were done in camera. Cats, as it turns out, have a retina that reflects light. Not a lot of animals have this attribute, but cats do. The film crew put a light directly above the camera lens, so when they were shooting with the cats, it would reflect into the camera. So that's kind of cool.
That made sense.
That wasn't done in post. They just used a light, and it just reflected off the cat's eyes and made it look like they were glowing.
Some good practical work.
Mm-hmm. For the scene when Lewis discovers Judd's body, a sculpture of Fred Gwynn's head was used rather than the actor himself. This is why the shot of Judd's body is so brief.
That makes sense.
Like when he's just like sitting there dead on the ground with his mouth open, like it still looked really good.
Yeah.
It honestly still looked good. The discussion as to how to present the zombie gauge on screen touched at one point on the possibility of using a little person. Instead, they wisely settled on a combination of the real Miko Hughes and a puppet. Anytime there was blood, that was a puppet, because the film crew didn't want to traumatize Miko.
Oh.
Here we go. I'm going to end with this one because it's funny. They had to shoot Pascal's Don't Make Me Tell You Twice scene two times because it was felt that Dale Midkiff looked too sexy because he was sleeping shirtless.
Nope, too hot. Redo it.
Nope, got to do it again.
Should we get into our ratings?
I think we should. Yeah, there isn't any other lore we wanted to talk about.
I don't think so, no. So what do you pick as your
weapon?
Your weapon?
Well, I mean, come on. What's better than a scalpel-wielding three-year-old? Reanimated three-year-old. I had a better weapon than that, though. I feel like...
I'm still deciding between two.
I'm not doing a syringe. Oh, of course. Oh, no. I wanted to do a fucking Mack truck going 70 miles down the fucking road.
Uh-huh. One of my options is an 18-wheeler Renko truck. Then I'll go with my other one.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm doing a Mack truck.
That's it.
What I'm doing. All right. So for my reading. Okay. So for quality... It's hard, right? Because like this movie's got some pretty cheesy acting in it. But if I'm thinking about it from like the first time watching it and it being like something that hasn't been done before, it has some really clever moments in it. And I kind of like some of the little details that it gives in terms of like Pascal's character coming in and like influencing the story. Even though there are some pitfalls with like Gage's death and me just kind of feeling like, how are you not watching him? And them not doing a really good job of making it obvious that like there are other forces at play that really like pushed him into the road. I'd probably give it like maybe, I'm going to say 3.5 Mack trucks out of 5.
Yeah. I love this movie and I didn't rate it well.
Yeah. For quality at least. Yeah. Like, I don't know. I'm thinking like the acting wasn't super great, but I did like some of the characters. I liked the setting. I liked some of the kills in it. The ending was pretty good. So I'm comfortable with 3.5. For scariness, fucking God, I don't know, like a one out of 5 Mack trucks. It was more funny to me personally. Yeah. It was more of like a dramatic, more tense movie to me than anything else. Just really, it wasn't scary. But for rewatchability, I'd probably rate it a little bit higher. I'd probably give it more like a 4 or 4.5 out of 5 because it's not too long. I think it would be a great date night moving. I liked what you had said earlier about how like it was a fairly soft pitch for Nick because it isn't super gory or super scary. So it's kind of nice to show to people who might not be really ready for those really high tension horror movies, but still has some clever twists and turns in it.
Yeah. So like I had said, I love this movie and I love the book. These will always have a special place in my heart. However, I have to rate it honestly.
Yeah.
So my weapon was initially going to be an 18-wheel Orenco truck, but my second option was a syringe of that good. So we'll say a syringe of that good. Quality, I gave it a 3 out of 5. I feel like for the time, maybe well-executed-ish, right. But like it's hard to think about when you have a movie like The Shining that came out before this, mm-hmm. or like Halloween that came out before this, right. and all of that. And think about how much better executed those were.
Absolutely.
It kind of takes away from it a little bit, especially knowing that like the person who originated the story wrote the screenplay.
You're like, what happened?
Yeah. I'm curious. Maybe it was just like King's vision and the director's vision didn't necessarily pan out to work well together.
Yeah, just because you're the writer doesn't mean that like you're like the director and the writer are two very, very different roles.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe like they both had such different visions that it didn't come together correctly.
Yep. Not to mention just like in the editing room.
Yeah.
Right. Like when things just get cut, but like really helped the storyline along.
Yeah. For scariness, I also gave it like a 2 out of 5. Mm-hmm. If I watched mm-hmm. it back then, maybe it would have hit. But now it wasn't scary at all.
I'm trying to think of like if I didn't know that Gage was going to die.
Yeah.
Would it have been really, really scary after that point? But because maybe that's part of the reason why it didn't hit that hard is because I kind of knew the movie going in.
Yeah. But now we're cheering on the truck. for rewatchability, I gave it a 4 out of 5. Mm-hmm. I think it's entertaining.
It's super entertaining.
Yeah.
It's a very, it's a very interesting movie. I like the lore that it goes into. I love like Judd as the character. He really carries it though. Cause like he fucking does. Lewis's character is hard to listen to or watch. And he takes up most of the screen time.
Yeah. And I would rewatch this just for Judd over and over and over again.
Absolutely.
And then I also did a rereadability score and I gave that a 4.5 out of 5 because it's a damn good book.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. If I even remotely liked the movie, I'm sure the book is fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Especially if it goes just more in kind of the backstory and the lore and why characters made certain decisions. Although you had said that Pascal doesn't necessarily drive the narrative as forward in the book as he does in the movie, or does he?
He does a little bit, but not as much.
Like he probably influences Lewis in a couple of ways in terms of not only making him feel guilty, but also like bringing him to the burial ground and telling him about how dangerous it is. Like I'm assuming that same incident happens in the book where Lewis goes and then wakes up the next morning and his shoes are dirty. Right. Yeah. Like I assumed that was in the book.
Yeah. So that's in the book. Him talking to Ellie's in the book. Like
That makes sense too.
Yeah,
right? Like,
yeah, there's a few things that are still there, but it just doesn't seem quite. He doesn't seem to play as major of a role in what pans out
in the book versus the movie.
Yeah,
got it.
It's still a big role, just not that big.
Yeah,
but yeah, I'm gonna reread it. I thought it was really good, and I wouldn't say it's King's best,
right?
But like, it was a good read, and it's emotional. Like,
oh, I'm sure
you get sad.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't bring this up earlier because it wasn't in like the movie trivia, but I had heard like a rumor that King didn't want to publish this for the longest time because I don't know if it was just because it scared him or if it was because like he was worried about how dark of a story it was.
Yeah.
Right. Like the material that he was going into.
Yeah. But anywho, last part. What you been up to?
What doing?
Yeah, what doing?
What doing?
In the word of every Indian ringneck,
what doing? Doing? I was like, what doing? Make it big. What have I been doing? Make it big. What have I been doing? I I've been taking a bit of a break from a lot of my physical activities because I kind of got an injury. I like got an injury doing some lead climbing with Eve where they took like an unexpected fall. And I think I just like tweaked my wrist when I caught them. Nobody got injured or anything, but like I think the day after that, I went to the archery range and I like shot my bow for like well over 2 hours. And the day after that, I was pretty sore. And I noticed like I had to wear a brace to work for a couple of days. And it was funny. I was like diagnosing it with Harrison the other night. Where I was like, I'm trying to figure out like, why does this one muscle in my shoulder hurt? And so he gave me a resistance band and he's like, pull this resistance band. Like you're pulling back a bow and arrow. I pulled it back and it hurt right in that spot. And I was like, oh, that's it.
Yeah.
So I just tried to Katniss Everdeen myself and injured myself. But went and did some light rock climbing a few days ago on my own. Just went for auto belay day. And I ended up meeting a couple of really awesome like little kids. They're probably like, I don't know, maybe like 11 and 12. I don't exactly know. They're like a brother and sister. And it was just kind of cool to hang out with them and kind of feel like the cool aunt that was like showing them all these different rock climbing moves.
Yeah.
And then yesterday, I had a really eventful day yesterday. I went rock climbing, got some lead in with Eve, and then climbed some pretty hard routes with Zach and Eve. And then I went to a couple of like cool bookstores on Alberta.
Oh, hell yeah.
There's like a new horror bookstore that opened on Alberta like a couple of weeks ago. I should look up their information. I'll like send it to you so you can like drop it.
Yes, please.
And then we also went to Parallel Worlds on Alberta Street too.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't think I've ever even heard of that.
Oh, well, you should definitely check it out. Yeah. It's super, super cool because it's like, it's basically like a sci-fi bookstore, but they have a lot of books, but it is super small. Like it's like half the size of this room right here. Maybe it's about from like here to that black pillar and back, mm-hmm. right? But it's floor to ceiling, wall to wall, like books.
Nice.
And I bought a Terry Pratchett book there for Harrison. Like nice. Found like a paperback, like an old paperback. And then I bought myself a steel book from the horror bookstore. It was Kiki's Delivery Service. So I was Sick. Pretty fucking stoked about that.
Yeah. I didn't even know they were making a horror bookstore.
Yeah. I'll send you it. We should go check it out sometime because it was super cute. Also kind of like a little bit of a hole in the wall, like a very tiny, very cute. And it had like, I would say 50% movies, 50% books.
Oh, sick.
Yeah. And it had a very good section of like vintage old like VHS tapes and then like stuff that like movies that literally came out like months ago.
I'm always so nervous about bookstores opening in Portland because I'm like, you have to compete with Powell's.
I know.
Yeah.
I know, but it's cute. Like Alberta yeah. Street, I think is the place to do that. Cause Alberta Street, like, I mean, just basically from 33rd all the way to 7th is all just like shops.
Yeah.
And then apartment buildings that are above those shops.
Yeah.
So it's like a place where people go and they park and then they just walk down that street and they'll just bop into every single store.
That's like, they're living us on a different timeline.
Right.
Horror book and movie store.
Mm-hmm. We'll go check it out sometime. Yeah. I'd love to take you there. It's very, very cool. And I was very impressed by their lineup. Their prices are decent. And I love Parallel Worlds too. That's actually where Zach proposed to Eve.
Oh, sick.
So it was kind of cute to be able to go there and like, you know, hang out with. It was a separate hangout too, because it was just myself, Zach, and Stevie, because the three of us all like horror. And so I think it was Zach that suggested it. Like, hey, I found out there was this horror bookstore that was nearby. Like, do you guys want to go? And we were like, fuck yeah. So it's kind of cool to just go like on a mini adventure.
Sick. And I'll link them in the show notes too so that they have a little shout out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. What about you? What have you been up to?
I've been doing a lot of reading.
Yeah.
I went to the doctor last week and I am, for the foreseeable future, banned from climbing.
No.
It's a mixture of a strain that I did while I was bouldering and the repetitive motion from the portafilters at work.
Right.
But essentially I have an issue in my wrist and it's one of those things where it's like, if I don't do the occupational therapy and rest it a lot right now, it becomes a permanent issue. And so I have to just like, essentially
do you have like
do it
exercises?
Yeah, I have a couple of exercises that are in my email, and then trying to schedule occupational therapy is tricky because mm-hmm. it's all out of pocket, so that's gonna suck. But I just have to, like, I'm doing Leela's dental stuff right now, so I can't do that too.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been shitty to just get my membership back. And well, then, like, literally days after the $100 thing comes out, they're like, by the way, you can't climb anymore.
Yeah, actually, you can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder if they could tell you what kind of a strain it was so you could go and just, like, Google PT exercises for that strain.
I'm going to look into it because it's a disease.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
Like, it's a strain, but it also, like, causes a bigger issue, I guess.
Got it.
But yeah, it's some bullshit, essentially, where, like, it's the tendons in my wrist that are causing issues. But aside from that, I also have tennis elbow, which I guess is really common in climbers.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
And that fucking sucks.
I fucking hate tennis elbows. It fucking
sucks. Yeah. That was like a week and a half of constant pain.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, just, you don't realize how much you need your elbow and like how much like it debilitates that arm when you can't use it.
Yeah. And I think I was honestly able to overcome a lot of the wrist pain while I was climbing.
But the elbow pain.
That elbow pain, fucking bad.
Different.
Bad.
Absolutely. Agree.
That, yeah. So I have a couple exercises for that too.
Good.
And I'm going to just take it really
easy. Yeah, take it easy. Even if you want to come with, like if you just want to come watch,
yeah,
take pictures. Like if you ever want to come do that, we can definitely do that too.
I think I might do that. Yeah. Because it's poopy not to be able to do it.
Absolutely. Especially when you were just getting into it. It's been hard for me because like I said, when I injured myself, like going really hard for archery, now I've been trying to recover and like telling myself like I can't get good overnight. I need to like take it easy and really build that muscle structure up and probably do other things on top of it.
Yeah.
So I've been trying to like focus more on my nutrition and trying to do other exercises, like even if they're like low weight bearing exercises or just like body weight exercises.
That's one thing, is I've been really shitty about going to the gym lately. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, this just gives me a reason to like get back to the gym, start strengthening those things up.
Right.
And have like a motivation to do it.
Absolutely.
Have a goal that I'm shooting for.
Right.
But since I haven't been able to climb, I got outside with Harrison. That was really fun.
Yeah.
On our, was supposed to be a backpacking trip, turned into carrying a backpack on a day pack or on a day trip.
Just doing some conditioning.
It was fun.
Yeah.
It was a good time. Anytime outside with Harrison is a good time.
And it was pretty
and
too.
And it was gorgeous.
Right?
Yeah. It was nice. A beautiful day. But then since I haven't been able to climb after work, I've been doing a lot of reading. So since we recorded last, I read The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho.
Hmm.
I'm going through my reading all my favorite people's favorite books things.
Yeah.
And that's Chase's favorite book. It was good. It was fine.
Yeah.
I can get why people think that it's a big deal.
Right.
I think if I were to have read it like 10 years ago, it would have hit me harder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. You get to check another one off the list, right?
Exactly.
They don't all have to be winners.
No.
Yeah.
No. And I recognize that like, I like a much different story than a lot of people that I know do.
Absolutely.
So I think for what it is, it was a great book. It just wasn't necessarily my cup of tea,
for
but
sure.
It was still good.
For sure.
And then I finished The Painted Bird by Jerzy Kosinski.
Hmm.
I had mentioned Steps by him a few episodes ago. And this one is another like pseudo autobiographical story, but it's about his time growing up in Eastern Europe during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And it's essentially just like this 7-year-old kid whose parents send him off because they know that their political affiliation in their town paints a target on their backs for the Germans. And so he gets sent off to go live somewhere that they thought was going to be better. And then it's how like everybody that he ends up with either like dies or ends up pushing him off into the woods, or like he ends up being orphaned over and over and over again.
Oh.
And kind of the horrors that he sees. And it's a wonderful book. Very dark, very hard to get through, but beautifully written.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you brought up books, because that's one other thing I forgot to mention, is that I actually just finished a book the other day. I finished Vicious by V.E. Schwab.
Ooh.
Which I'm excited for, because that was a book that was recommended to Harrison and I by his aunt and cousin. They really enjoyed that book and they wanted us to read it because V.E. Schwab is coming to Portland in June.
Oh,
coming
okay.
for like an event. And Harrison and I were reading it back and forth together for a minute, and then we kind of fell off of it because we're just not really great readers. So I rented it on Libby and have been listening to it, because compared to Skeleton Crew and It, which were both 47 and 45 hours respectively, this was a whopping like 9 hours, I think.
Sick.
So it was like super easy to get through.
Yeah.
And it was a fantastic book. I felt like the first probably third of it, it jumps between all of these different timelines, you know, like 10 years ago, 2 nights ago, today, 2 years ago, 10 years ago, tonight, like day, right? Like it keeps switching back and forth. And so for that first like third of the book, I felt myself like not really getting into it. There was too many characters and I couldn't like wrap my head around it. But then it eventually got to a point where it all started to like, all the cards just started to stack together.
Ooh,
when you like shuffle them
I
all.
I love that.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh,
I love that. I love a like scattered plot that ends up just kind of like folding perfectly into itself.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
and
good.
And you're just like, ooh. Yeah. So it's fucking good. Have I told you about it?
I don't think so.
If I just think of like a spoiler free, it's about like one of like superheroes weren't necessarily good people, right? It's about this concept of EOs, extraordinary people. So it's about like a like kind of centers on a character named Victor Vale, and he's trying to like kind of, it's kind of like he's enacting revenge. He's trying to like understand EOs and like what they mean for like the greater good of the world. And he's also trying to combat, you know, like another force that's trying to like eliminate EOs. And so it's like, it's kind of like it's a bit of a cat and mouse game. It's kind of both a damaged protagonist and an unreliable narrator, where you're like, can I actually trust this person that I'm following? Is this actually the good guy or is this the bad guy? And it definitely, it gives that kind of Invincible or The Boys vibe, where it's like people who have supernatural abilities are not necessarily good people.
Oh, okay.
And it's also this concept of like when people gain superhuman abilities, supernatural abilities, this concept of like X-Men, where like they don't necessarily know what those powers are or how to control them. And so they kind of have to like learn all that stuff at the same time.
Yeah. Interesting. I might have to check that out. I'm admittedly not a big sci-fi person, but that sounds like something I would like.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would call it sci-fi, but maybe that's just because I think of sci-fi as like things that are strictly in space or things that are not, it's not just fiction, because it's like fiction that has some sort of like scientific element to it, which I guess this is kind of doing.
I guess this is like fantasy.
Yeah.
Not like men on horses fantasy, but a different kind of fantasy.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Not like dragons and unicorns fantasy, but more like just not like our current reality, right? In a parallel world where like some of the same rules and societies apply, but what if there were also like a new emerging subset of people who have like innate abilities?
I love that when we think of fantasy, I'm like men on horses, you're like dragons and unicorns.
Right. And just this concept of like science fiction, right? Because like science fiction is supposed to be fiction that goes really like out of the box, but it's out of the box in like a could be real way.
Yeah. In a rooted in scientific theory
that
sort of stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Where like typical fiction is like could be anything, has its own subset of rules. Could go anywhere. It doesn't really have to apply by any rules that we subscribe to.
Yeah, kids get reanimated and stab you with scalpels.
Yeah. But anyways, yeah. So Finish Vicious, highly recommend it. There is a sequel to it that I think is called Vengeance. They gave you like a little blurb at the end of it, but I was like, I'm good with just listening to this one for now.
Yeah.
And digesting it, but highly recommend it. Very, very good book.
Hell yeah.
I like how dark it was, honestly.
I'm going to finish the one that I'm currently on, and then I'm rereading Blood Meridian.
Ooh.
And I'm so fucking stoked
for
it.
Oh,
they're about to make a TV show out of it.
Oh, shit, really?
Yeah. I don't know how they're going to put that on screen. This is easily the most brutal book I've ever read. And
I don't know. People would probably watch it, though.
oh, I don't know how they're going
to
do it.
I have two other exciting things to tell you. So yeah. One, I'm pretty excited that when we went to Parallel Worlds yesterday, I didn't convince her, but I just like, I noticed right before we left that Parallel Worlds had an old ass copy of Audrey Rose.
Ooh.
And I was, it was the same as my copy that I loaned you.
Yeah.
And I looked at it and I was like, oh my God, this book is so good. And I picked it up and Stevie was like, what's that book about? And I just kind of gave her like a little blurb of it. And she was like, I'm getting it. Like, it's only $6. Like, I'm buying it. I hear you've convinced me. My final thing that I'm excited about is I just found out that, Love, Death and Robots is releasing another season.
Ooh, that's exciting.
Which I'm stoked for because I just got my tattoo. So.
Hell yeah. So. Sick.
That's yeah. It. That's all.
That's it. That's all.
That's it. That's all.
All right. Well, bye.
Have a great night.
You're so much nicer than I am.
Hey, everybody. It's Karina. I'd like to tell you of a couple of announcements. We have got a Patreon now. You can subscribe at patreon.com/ It's Always Spooky. For $5 a month, we will be having some very special features, so stay tuned for those. Starting with every week, we'll be posting what episode we're planning on doing. So please make sure that you post your scariest and your favorite scenes so that we can feature them in the episode. If Patreon isn't your speed, you can also send us a tip on our Ko-fi account. That's ko-fi.com/ It's Always Spooky. Please, please, please also email us your spooky stories and any recommendations to itsalwaysspookypodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much. It's Always Spooky.